some sort of notification, some sort of message sent specifically to us in the reliefs on Pillar 43. Before even beginning to consider what that message might speak of, the first step is to confirm that Paul Burley's discovery is a solid one. I'm already persuaded by his identification of Sagittarius with the vulture, and of the disk held up by its wing with the sun. The general context of the surrounding constellations is also an excellent fit. Could it be, however, that the reliefs on the pillar do indeed depict the sun's conjunction with Sagittarius and the center of the Milky Way, but at some time other than the winter solstice in the years between 1960 and 2040? Of course, the winter solstice alignment recurs once every 26,000 years, so in 24,000 BC, the sun would have been seen in Sagittarius, targeting the center of the galaxy exactly as it does today. And this rare alignment will happen again 26,000 years from now, in other words, in AD 28,000. It's not impossible that any hypothetical message could be to do with these remote dates. It's intriguing, however, that there's another message from a completely different culture, the ancient Maya, that uses the same system of coordinates and that is indeed focused very exactly on the years between 1960 and 2040. Meanwhile, at Göbekli Tepe, there are also the three other key moments of the year to consider, the summer solstice and the two equinoxes. Was there any alignment through Sagittarius with the center of the galaxy at any of these three other stations of the sun in the epoch of 9600 BC when Göbekli Tepe was built? I know from my work on ancient Egypt that the sun was in Leo on the spring equinox in 10800 BC. Now a few moments on the computer confirmed that this remained the case 1,200 years later. In 9,600 BC, the equinox sun was still in Leo and was thus at a point on its ecliptic path that was very far from any alignment with the center of the galaxy. I feel quite safe, therefore, in ruling out the spring equinox, at least in that epoch. The same is also true for the autumn equinox in 9,600 BC. Because the sun was then in the constellation of Aquarius, and again very far from alignment with the center of the galaxy, I rule it out too. Moreover, after reminding myself of the orientation of all the enclosures at Göbekli Tepe, it becomes clear that the equinoxes can be ruled out in all periods. This is the case because all of the four major enclosures, A, B, C, and D, remember, Pillar 43 is in enclosure D, have a very definite northwest to southeast orientation. None of them come anywhere near to due east, where the equinox sun rises, or due west, where the equinox sun sets. If the builders of Göbekli Tepe had wished to direct our attention to either of the equinoxes in a piece of symbolic art like Pillar 43, their very first step would have been to provide an obvious clue by aligning the site east to west. Since they did not do so, it is safe to assume that events at the equinoxes were not what they had in mind. This leaves us with the solstices. The sun rises south of east and sets south of west on the winter solstice. On the summer solstice, it rises north of east and sets north of west. In theory, therefore, sunrise alignments south of east on the winter solstice and sunset alignments north of west on the summer solstice can be considered as relevant to the northwest to southeast orientation of Göbekli Tepe. As we've seen, a winter solstice alignment involving the sun, Sagittarius, and the center of the galaxy can be ruled out for 9600 BC, since the alignment only occurs in our own epoch, or in 24,000 BC, or in AD 28,000. On the winter solstice in 9600 BC, the sun was in Taurus and very far from alignment with the center of the galaxy. A summer solstice sunrise alignment north of east can also be ruled out not only in 9600 BC, but in all epochs, given the site's distinct southeast to northwest orientation. By a process of deduction, therefore, we are left with only one possible alignment that might work in 9600 BC, and this is to the summer solstice sunset, north of west, which presents no conflict to the general southeast to northwest orientation of Göbekli Tepe. Moreover, computer simulations show that on the summer solstice in the epoch of 9600 BC, the sun was in the constellation of Scorpio, and while it did not align with the center of the galaxy, having moved past the dark rift and the nuclear bulge, it was still reasonably close to that target. As the reader will recall, Sagittarius and Scorpio straddle the dark rift and the nuclear bulge, but it is in Sagittarius, not Scorpio, that the exact alignment with the center of the galaxy occurs. Nonetheless, it seems reasonable to accept the summer solstice sunset north of west in the epoch of 9600 BC as a candidate for the scene depicted on Pillar 43. A relatively minor error of draftsmanship by the sculptor who carved the figures would in theory be enough to explain the discrepancy. There is, however, a difficulty which Andrew Collins, his colleague Rodney Hale, and the mathematicians Alessandro De Lorenzis and Vincenzo Orofino all seem to have missed in their focus on possible alignments towards the northwest, specifically to the setting of the star Deneb in the constellation of Cygnus, reviewed in the last chapter. Deneb did indeed set north of west in the epoch of 9600 BC, in alignment with the orientation of enclosure D. But this alignment, though accurate enough, was purely theoretical, and could never, in fact, have been observed from enclosure D, for the simple reason that enclosure D is built into the side of the steep ridge of the Tepe that arises to the north of the main group of enclosures. No observation of the setting of Deneb would have been possible from enclosure D, and for the same reason, no observation of the summer solstice sunset would have been possible. The sun would have dropped out of sight behind the ridge for approximately 20 minutes before it actually set, and in order to observe its setting, it would have been necessary to leave enclosure D and climb the ridge. For this reason, therefore, combined with the fact that the sun in Scorpio, while close, does not target the center of the galaxy, a summer solstice sunset alignment must also be ruled out. When you have eliminated the impossible, Arthur Conan Doyle's character Sherlock Holmes famously pronounced, then whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. By a process of elimination, we have seen that Göbekli Tepe cannot be inviting us to consider the equinoxes, and nor can it be inviting us to consider the summer solstice, even at the favorable moment of sunset. This leaves us only with the winter solstice, with the sun in Sagittarius, targeting the center of the Milky Way galaxy, the definitive astronomical signature of the years between 1960 and 2040 in our own epoch, a signature that recurs only at 26,000-year intervals. However improbable it may seem, therefore, we are obliged to consider the possibility that in 9600 BC, the builders of Göbekli Tepe were already so advanced in their knowledge of the recondite phenomenon of precession that they were able to calculate its effects for thousands of years backward and forward in time in order to produce an accurate symbolic picture of the Sagittarius winter solstice conjunction. If this speculation is correct, then it is appropriate to remind ourselves that two comparable scientific achievements of prehistoric antiquity have also survived the ages and come down to us in the same degree of completeness. One is the Mayan calendar that envisaged a great cycle in the life of the world coming to an end in exactly the same 80-year period between 1960 and 2040. Moreover, it used exactly the same yardstick. The progress of the winter solstice sun towards alignment with the center of our galaxy, to predict when the fateful conjunction would occur, and to define the cusp between the end of the old age and the beginning of the new. The other is the grand astronomical geoglyph of Egypt's Giza Plateau, inscribed on the west bank of the Nile in the forms of the Great Pyramids and the Great Sphinx. The reader will recall that these masterpieces of megalithic architecture deploy a deep knowledge of precession to offer us a picture of the sky on the spring equinox in 10,800 BC. Here too, as we shall see in chapter 19, there are distinctive characteristics of a message sent across the ages and directed quite specifically at our time and at us. In our search to discover what these messages might mean, perhaps the Sabians of Haran, those star worshippers whose city lies barely 25 miles from Göbekli Tepe, those followers of the wisdom god, with their mysterious pilgrimages to the pyramids of Giza, will be able to give us a clue. Chapter 16, Written in the Stars. In chapters 8 to 11, we explored the secret tradition of the sages, maintained in Egypt for thousands of years, perpetuating itself through recruitment and initiation down the ages. And we considered the possibility that these mystery teachers of heaven, these followers of Horus, these magicians of the gods, played a key role, not once but many times, at crucial moments in Egyptian history in moving that remarkable culture forward. In chapter 12, we looked into the connection between the incredible megalithic site of Baalbek and an enigmatic group of colonists from ancient Canaan who settled near Egypt's Giza Plateau, where they made regular devotional offerings to the Great Sphinx, named by them variously as Horon or Hurna, after a Canaanite falcon deity. In chapter 14, we saw that another group, known as the Sabians, and renowned as star worshippers, came from even further away as pilgrims to the pyramids of Giza. Their home city was Haran, located near Göbekli Tepe in what is now southeastern Turkey. There is no record of when these pilgrimages began, but Haran had already been settled for thousands of years, when the earliest surviving written reference to it appears in an inscription dated to around 2000 BC. What is remarkable is that Sabian pilgrimages to Giza were still taking place as late as AD 1228, when the Arab geographer Yakut al-Hamawi mentioned them in his Mogam el-Buldan, Dictionary of Countries. As Egyptologist Salim Hassan notes in the passage quoted in chapter 14, Hamawi's account shows that the Sabians fully recognized the pyramids of Khufu and Khafre as being monuments connected with the stellar cult. This may seem like a small point, and experts on the Sabians have ignored it. But it proves the continuation of a hidden tradition. Ancient Egyptian religion and ancient Egyptian culture ceased to exist hundreds of years before AD 1228. The last known inscription in sacred hieroglyphs dates to AD 394. While Egyptologists did not rediscover the evidence of the stellar nature of the pyramid cult until the early 1900s. There is therefore no way other than a hidden tradition that the Sabian star worshippers could have known the pyramids were connected to the stars, or could have been motivated to make them objects of pilgrimage. Ah, but Haran, Haran, the fabled city of the Sabians. What a lowly mess it is today. Fashioned from mud brick, a few of the traditional beehive-shaped houses still survive, grouped together into a center retailing trinkets for the amusement of tourists. The ramshackle modern town is located in the midst of a vast, desolate plain, with the ridges of the Taurus Mountains, blue and hazy, looming 25 miles, 40 kilometers, to the north. Göbekli Tepe stands on one of those ridges, and indeed the two sites are theoretically intervisible. In other words, if your eyes were good enough, you could see Göbekli Tepe from Haran and vice versa. What would have made such a sighting easier in antiquity would have been a tall tower annexed to the temple that once stood here, a temple dedicated to Su-En, usually contracted to Sin, the moon god of the Sabians. After telling us that there were powerful images in this temple, the Greek philosopher Libanius, AD 314-394, describes the tower, noting that from its top one could overlook the entire plain of Haran. The temple of the moon god was already remotely ancient in the first millennium BC, when we know from inscriptions that several restorations were required. For example, repairs were carried out on it by the Assyrian king Shalmaneser III, 859-824 BC, and by Ashurbanipal, 685-627 BC. Later, Nabonidus, who ruled the Neo-Babylonian Empire from 556-539 BC, rebuilt the temple. Like Thutmosis IV of Egypt, who restored the Great Sphinx of Giza, Nabonidus was inspired by a dream to undertake this work. It is a remarkable thing that the pagan religion of Harran survived for several hundred years into the Islamic era. This owed much to the acceptance of the Sabians as a people of the book. The reader will recall that they successfully claimed Hermes as their prophet and offered a compilation of the Hermetic texts as their scriptures. Thus, when the Arab general Ibn Ghanem conquered Harran in the 7th century AD, he co-opted the site where stood the temple of the moon god with its fabulous tower for the construction of a grand mosque. It seems that the temple was destroyed to make way for the mosque, but that Ghanem offered the Sabians an alternative site in the city where they were permitted to build a new temple. They continued to practice their star worship there without significant disruption until the 11th century AD, when either in 1032 or in 1081, accounts are conflicting, a new generation of Muslim rulers turned against them, suppressed their faith, and destroyed their last temple. 2 centuries later, the Mongol invasions began, and Harran was frequently the scene of fierce conflicts. In a succession of episodes in 1259, 1262, and 1271, the city's Islamic places of worship were destroyed. The Grand Mosque still lies in ruins today, but when we remember that the Temple of the Moon God once stood here under a lofty tower, it's curious that the one almost intact architectural remnant with a square base measuring only 4 meters, 13 feet on each side, stands more than 50 meters, 164 feet tall, and overlooks the Harran Plain, just as its Sabian predecessor did. No doubt it is merely a surviving minaret of Ibn Ghanem's Grand Mosque. The architecture is definitely Islamic. Still, it is thought-provoking, to say the least, that local people refer to it to this day as the Astronomical Tower, as though preserving an ancient memory of the time when their Sabian ancestors climbed the long-vanished spire of the Temple of the Moon God to observe the heavens. The few archaeological expeditions mounted in Harran from the 1950s onwards, while finding a number of inscriptions relating to the Moon God, have as yet revealed no physical traces of the pre-Islamic temples. A team from the Chicago Oriental Institute was about to start a major dig around the ruins of the Grand Mosque in 1986, but it seems that the Turkish authorities insisted on such restrictive practices that the project had to be abandoned. Current excavations by Harran University and the Sanliurfa Museum Directorate show little interest in recovery of substantive remains from the city's pre-Islamic period. Thus far, based on the minimal archaeology done, datable artifacts from Harran itself go back to around 5000 BC, though there's every possibility that older remains will be found with further excavations. At a settlement mound called Asagi Yarimka, a few kilometers northwest of the city, characteristic Halaf monochrome wares dating to 6000 BC have been collected. And 6 kilometers south of Harran, excavations since 2006 by Turkish archaeologist Nurettin Yardimici have established the existence of an even older permanent settlement dated to 8000 BC. Since 8000 BC, 10,000 years ago, marks the approximate epoch in which Göbekli Tepe was abandoned and the last of its stone circles deliberately buried, I was intrigued to learn that the site of Yardimici's excavations has been known since time immemorial as Tel Idris, in other words, the settlement mound of Idris. This is interesting because Idris in the Quran is the name of the biblical prophet Enoch, the 7th of the 10 patriarchs who lived in the times before the flood. To be specific, Enoch is the son of Jared, the father of Methuselah, the grandfather of Lamech, and the great-grandfather of Noah himself. Moreover, Muslim traditions associate Idris Enoch with Hermes. The Persian Islamic philosopher Abu Mashar, AD 787-886, expresses the matter as follows. The name Hermes is a title. Its first bearer, who lived before the flood, was he whom the Hebrews call Enoch, whose name in Arabic is Idris. The Haranians declare his prophethood. This antediluvian Enoch Idris Hermes was a master of the sciences, especially astronomy. In addition, he wrote many books whose wisdom he preserved on the walls of Egyptian temples lest it be lost. It was he who constructed the pyramids. Abu Mashar's comments contain strong echoes of the Edfu building texts, also supposedly derived from lost antediluvian books and inscribed on the walls of the Temple of Horus to ensure that their message would not be lost. And the sense here that the pyramids are remotely ancient and were built by Hermes, that master of astronomy, the Egyptian Thoth, as the reader will recall, finds resonance with the tradition of the number of the secret chambers of the sanctuary of Thoth, reported in chapter 11, which in historic times the pharaoh Khufu wished to consult and copy in his own construction works at Giza. Once again, confronted by such material, it doesn't seem unreasonable to suppose that we may have stumbled across the traces of a project set in motion by the survivors of a global flood cataclysm to bring about the resurrection of the former world of the gods. Wherever this project took root, it seems to me its essence was a tradition passed down from generation to generation by initiated masters and thus theoretically capable of implementation in any place and in any epoch when the time was right. With their ability to blend in and survive changing circumstances, with their knowledge of the astronomical qualities of the pyramids preserved until at least as late as the 13th century AD, and with their very name, as Salim Hassan rightly recognized, derived from spa, the ancient Egyptian word for star, the Sabians of Haran have all the hallmarks of carriers of the secret tradition. Mystery of the Watchers. Apart from his genealogy in the line of patriarchs before Noah, and the enigmatic statements that he walked with God and was mysteriously taken up by God without experiencing death, the canonical Bible has nothing else to tell us about Enoch. Happily, much more information is available in several ancient non-canonical works, in other words, works that biblical redactors, for one reason or another, chose not to include within the officially sanctioned scriptures. Of these, the most famous by far is the Book of Enoch. Prior to the 18th century, scholars had believed it to be irretrievably lost, composed long before the birth of Christ and considered to be one of the most important pieces of Jewish mystical literature. It was only known from fragments and from references to it in other texts. All this changed, however, after polymath adventurer James Bruce of Kinnaird visited Ethiopia in the years 1770 to 1772. Amongst other remarkable achievements there, he procured and brought back to Britain several copies of the Book of Enoch that in antiquity had been translated into Ge'ez, the Ethiopic sacred language. These were the first complete copies ever to be seen in Europe. I note in passing that the Book of Enoch has always been of great significance to Freemasonry. Indeed, certain Masonic rituals, in curious resonance with Islamic traditions, identify Enoch with the ancient Egyptian wisdom god Thoth and also with his Greek avatar Hermes. An entry in the Royal Masonic Cyclopedia, first published in 1877, tells us that Enoch was the inventor of writing, that he taught men the art of building, and that before the flood he feared that the real secrets would be lost, to prevent which he concealed the grand secret, engraven on a white oriental porphyry stone in the bowels of the earth. The Cyclopedia contains its own hint of a secret tradition transmitted down the ages when it further suggests that Enoch was himself a Freemason and that at the end of his days on earth he delivered up the Grand Master's office to Lamech. The Book of Enoch is a very strange document, purporting, amongst many other elements, to be a vision of the future cataclysm of the flood and why it is to be unleashed upon the world. In a series of dreams, Enoch receives advance notice of the warning that God will give to his descendant Noah, that a deluge is about to come upon the whole earth and destroy all that is on it. This, of course, is familiar ground, merely a précis or restatement of what we can read in Genesis. So too is the passage that follows, in which Enoch is given to understand that arrangements will be made for Noah to escape, so that his seed may be preserved for all the generations of the world. What comes next is intriguing. Regardless of the fact that the express purpose of God's deluge is to kill off most of mankind, apart, of course, from Noah and his descendants, there is talk of the need to heal the earth, which the angels have corrupted, that all the children of men may not perish through all the secret things which the watchers have disclosed and have taught their sons. This is only the second mention of these mysterious watchers in the Book of Enoch. The first, a few pages earlier, tells us nothing about them except that they shall quake at the prospect of the coming events. So far, we have no real clue as to who or what they are, except that they have transgressed some divine law by teaching secret things, apparently dangerous things, to humanity, and that they and most of the human race through the agency of the deluge are to be punished grievously because of this. Certain names of the watchers, or at any rate the leadership of the watchers, are given. Azazel, Semjaza, Armen, Rumjal, Turel, Armaros, Danjal, Kokabel, and about a dozen more. More specifically, we are told about the nature of the secret things that they taught to mankind. And Azazel taught men to make swords and knives and shields and breastplates, and made known to them the metals of the earth, and the art of working them, and bracelets, and ornaments, and the use of antimony, and the beautifying of the eyelids, and all kinds of costly stones, and all colouring tinctures. And there arose much godlessness, and they committed fornication, and they were led astray, and became corrupt in all their ways. Semjaza taught enchantments and root cuttings, Armaros the resolving of enchantments, Barakujal taught astrology, Kokabel the constellations, Ezekiel the knowledge of the clouds, Araquiel the signs of the earth, Shamsiel the signs of the sun, and Sariel the course of the moon. Next we begin to understand that the watchers are divided into two mutually opposed groups, because we read that the leaders of one group summon Enoch. Remember, this is all happening to him while he's in a dreamlike, visionary state, to deliver a message to the leaders of the other group, named as the Watchers of the Heaven. It seems that these Watchers of the Heaven, sometimes also referred to as the Heavenly Watchers, have defiled themselves with women, and have done as the children of the earth do, and have taken unto themselves wives. They have also wrought great destruction upon the earth. For this, they're going to be punished in various deeply unpleasant and terrifying ways. Obedient and dutiful, Enoch sets off, bearing his heavy message of murder and mayhem from the Watchers to the Watchers. So what's going on here? A more careful scan of the pages reveals the backstory. And it came to pass, when the children of men had multiplied, that in those days were born unto them beautiful and comely daughters. And the angels, the children of heaven, saw and lusted after them, and said to one another, Come, let us choose us wives from among the children of men, and beget us children. And Semjaza, who was their leader, said unto them, I fear ye will not indeed agree to do this deed, and I alone shall have to pay the penalty of a great sin. And they all answered him and said, Let us all swear an oath, and all bind ourselves by mutual imprecations not to abandon this plan, but to do this thing. Then swear they all together, and bound themselves by mutual imprecations upon it. And they were in all 200, who descended in the days of Jared on the summit of Mount Hermon. Now things are becoming clearer. Watchers is a general term referring to angels. Amongst them are bad angels. They want to have sex and make babies with beautiful human women, and while they're at it, as we can gather from passages quoted earlier, they're going to teach mankind a thing or two about metals and the constellations and the course of the sun and the moon, or the ecliptic, as this course, this path, is known to astronomers today. As the first step in implementing their plan, these bad watchers descend upon Mount Hermon, which happens to be in ancient Canaan, now the Lebanon, and only 45 miles, 73 kilometers, from Baalbek. Meanwhile, there are good angels, the holy angels who watch, amongst them Uriel, Raphael, Raguel, Michael, Saraquel, Gabriel and Remiel. And it is these good watcher angels who appear to Enoch in a dream and give him that message of death and destruction to take to the bad watcher angels on Mount Hermon. He tells us specifically where he received this dream. I went off and sat down at the waters of Dan, to the south of the west of Hermon. I fell asleep, and behold, a dream came to me, and visions fell down upon me, and I saw visions of chastisement, and a voice came, bidding me to tell it to the sons of heaven and reprimand them. And when I awakened, I came unto them. As I read these passages set before the flood, when the people of the Lebanon and ancient Turkey were still at the hunter-gatherer stage of development, it seems more and more obvious to me that Enoch is a shamanic figure, and like all shamans, everywhere, in all times and places, he sets great store by visions, which in his case come in the form of dreams received in sleep. What's interesting, however, is that when he wakes up from his visionary state, he's able to go to a real, physical place on Mount Hermon, where the bad watchers are, and talk to them face to face. And I recounted before them all the visions which I had seen in sleep, and I began to speak the words of righteousness, and to reprimand the heavenly watchers. Does this not suggest, rather strongly, that the bad watchers are physical beings? I don't know what the good watchers are, because they only appear to Enoch in his dreams. Quite possibly they are real at some level. Readers of my book Supernatural, which is about shamanism, will know my view that in altered states of consciousness, including dream states, the receiver wavelength of the brain may be retuned, allowing us to make contact with other dimensions of reality. But in Enoch's story, the bad watchers must be real, real on the earthly plane of physical existence, because when he wakes up, he's able to climb Mount Hermon and reprimand them. We must also entertain the possibility that the bad watchers, whoever or whatever they are, may not, in fact, be bad. All we can say is that they are judged to be bad and portrayed as bad in Enoch's dream visions. One possibility that we should keep in mind, alongside the alternative possibility that the Book of Enoch is just an ancient work of fantasy fiction, is that Enoch's encounters with the bad watchers really did happen, and that he hated and resented them for changes they were seeking to introduce to the hunter-gatherer way of life of his people. In that case, the reprimands he delivers to them, mediated through his subconscious as coming from the good watchers, might simply express his own deeply entrenched views, the views of a bigoted old shaman who feels threatened by change, even though he himself will later be transformed by his contacts with the watchers. There isn't space here to review the entire bizarre, impenetrable, wildly suggestive text of the Book of Enoch. What I'm interested in is the much more specific possibility that the 200 watchers who descended on Mount Hermon were indeed real beings, not phantasms. I'd like to understand more about what kind of beings they could have been, and I want to look at the picture Enoch paints of them, laden with hatred and resentment though it is, as bringing skills and sciences to our ancestors. Skills and sciences which ultimately will also be revealed to him by the good watchers, and with which his own name will come to be associated in legend and tradition. Mystery of the Nephilim. The watchers begin their development project in quite small ways, teaching charms and enchantments and the cutting of roots to humans, and making them acquainted with plants. This sounds fairly harmless. Apart from a bit of enchantment, it's not really above and beyond basic hunter-gatherer level skills. But pretty soon, as we saw earlier, our ancestors are being initiated into the secrets of metals, and how to make swords and knives, and how to study the heavens, and also how to beautify themselves with eye makeup and jewelry. In return, a bit like the GIs who allegedly bought favors from British women with gifts of nylon stockings, cigarettes and chewing gum during World War II, the watchers are getting sex. Lots of sex. And it seems this is what annoys Enoch the most. He speaks reprovingly, again and again, of the fornication of the watchers, of their lust for beautiful and comely human women who they sleep with, go into, and defile themselves with, and to whom they reveal all kinds of sins. From such admonishments we may reasonably deduce a number of things about the watchers, most particularly that they must be about the right size and shape, and equipped, moreover, with the necessary organs and impulses, to want, to have, and to enjoy sex with human women. To me, the obvious conclusion from this is that the watchers are, in fact, human, or at any rate, extremely closely related at the genetic level to anatomically modern human beings, close enough indeed to make human women pregnant and to have children of fornication with them. These offspring are not sickly, as one might expect from an even slightly mismatched genetic makeup. On the contrary, they thrive so vigorously that Enoch, or the good angel speaking through him, want not only to destroy the watchers, but also to destroy the children of the watchers. But there is something very odd about the hybrid offspring, at least if we take Enoch's word for it, because he tells us that when human women became pregnant by the watchers, they gave birth to great giants, whose height was 3,000 ells, who consumed all the acquisitions of men, and when men could no longer sustain them, the giants turned against them and devoured mankind. 3,000 ells is equivalent to 4,500 feet, or 1,371 meters. Whatever the truth behind this account may be, therefore, it's obvious the angry old shaman is embellishing it fantastically here in his bid to discredit the watchers. The prospect of human women giving birth to babies who would grow to more than a kilometer in height is patently absurd. Nonetheless, it brings us back to familiar biblical territory again. Indeed, to one of the more notorious passages in the book of Genesis, which reads, "And it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. And the Lord said, My spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he also is flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown." That's the King James Version, but other translations give the original word Nephilim that the King James Version translates as giants, and we read, "The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God went to the daughters of humans and had children by them. They were heroes of old, men of renown." So now, further clarity begins to emerge. A group of bad angels, watchers of the heaven, have come to earth, descended specifically on Mount Hermon in Lebanon, transferred some technology, mated with human females, and produced offspring who are in some way gigantic and are called Nephilim. Here's what we're told in the very next verses. "The Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. The Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled. So the Lord said, I will wipe from the face of the earth the human race I have created, and with them the animals, the birds, and the creatures that move along the ground, for I regret that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord." An amazing amount of credulous nonsense has proliferated around these verses in recent years on the internet, much of it deriving from the late Zechariah Sitchin's science fiction novels, notably the Earth Chronicles series, which he successfully passed off to the public as serious factual studies. I've already touched in chapter 13 on Sitchin's misrepresentations of Baalbek, and while I'm not saying that everything he wrote was fiction, he did throw in some quite valuable and interesting facts. His overall body of work is marred by enough blatant fabrications and fantasy to call for caution rather than immediate trusting acceptance on the part of his readers. His treatment of the subject of the Nephilim is a case in point. Claiming to be an expert in biblical languages, he asked, "What then does the term Nephilim mean?" Stemming from the Semitic root nephil, to be cast down, it means exactly what it says. It means those who were cast down upon earth. The problem, however, as Michael S. Heiser, a genuine biblical scholar and ancient Semitic languages expert, has conclusively demonstrated, is that Sitchin assumes Nephilim to come from the Hebrew word nafal, which usually means to fall. He then forces the meaning to come down onto the word, creating his to come down from above translation. In the form we find it in the Hebrew Bible, if the word Nephilim came from the Hebrew Nafal, it would not be spelled as we find it. The form Nephilim cannot mean fallen ones. The spelling would then be Nephulim. Likewise, Nephilim does not mean those who fall or those who fall away. That would be Benophilim. The only way in Hebrew to get Nephilim from Nafal, by the rules of Hebrew morphology, word formation, would be to presume a noun spelt nafil and then pluralize it. I say presume, since this noun does not exist in biblical Hebrew, unless one counts Genesis 6:4 and Numbers 13:33, the two occurrences of Nephilim. But that would then be assuming what one is trying to prove. However, in Aramaic, the noun nafilah does exist. It means giant, making it easy to see why the Septuagint, the ancient Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, translated Nephilim as gigantes, giant. Heiser is plainly right about this, because as he points out, there is a later passage in the Old Testament, in Numbers 13, where the word Nephilim appears again. This is thousands of years after the deluge, indeed in the historical period, surely not later than 1200 BC, when the Israelites first entered Canaan after the Exodus from Egypt. Advanced scouts report to Moses, "All the people we saw there are of great size. We saw the Nephilim there. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we looked the same to them." The context leaves no room for doubt that the Nephilim are people of great size. The references to them as giants in the King James and other versions of the Bible therefore make complete sense, and the translation that Sitchin gives is obviously bogus. Did he know it was bogus, even as he retailed it in his books? There can be no certainty because, as Heiser goes on to prove, Sitchin's grasp of biblical languages was so weak that he was unable to distinguish Aramaic from Hebrew. The notion that the Nephilim were beings who were cast down from heaven, or who came down from heaven, was deployed by Sitchin, Heiser believes, simply because it served his argument and allowed him to make the Nephilim sound like ancient astronauts. Again, the criticism is justified because Sitchin goes beyond what could be an innocent error to give further translations of the word Nephilim that are even more self-serving and phony. For example, he makes them gods of heaven upon earth, and worse still, the people of the rocket ships, an interpretation for which there is no possible justification in any ancient text, but that allows him to speak, amongst other egregious and deceptive fictions, of the aeronautics and space administration of the Nephilim. It is also important, while reviewing this material, which has had such an impact on public perceptions of the past, to be clear that the Watchers, who are never mentioned at all in the Bible, but are said in the Book of Enoch to have descended from heaven, are quite distinct from the Nephilim. There is nothing in the Book of Enoch that says the Nephilim fell or were cast down or came down from heaven in any way. The most we may gather from the Book of Enoch is that the Nephilim are the progeny of the mating of Watchers and human women. But even this is complicated. An authoritative English translation of the Ethiopic text, brought back by Bruce, was made by the Reverend R. H. Charles and first published in 1917. It contains no mention of the Nephilim and describes the Watcher human offspring simply as giants. Likewise, the word Nephilim does not appear in the 1979 translation of Professor Michael A. Nibb, which, as well as the Ethiopic text, takes account of newly discovered Aramaic fragments from the Dead Sea Scrolls. However, a more recent translation by George W. Nicholsberg and James C. Vanderkam, published in 2012, draws on further fragments not considered by Nibb. And here, in chapter 7, verse 2, the word Nephilim appears twice, as follows. "And they, human women, conceived from them, the Watchers, and bore to them great giants, and the giants begot Nephilim, and to the Nephilim were born Eliud, and they were growing in accordance with their greatness." The Nephilim do not appear again in the Nicholsberg and van der Kam translation. Nonetheless, the verse quoted above leaves no room for doubt. They are not to be considered as fallen, or cast down, or any such thing, but as the progeny of watcher human mating. Nor is it the first generation, the great giants, who are named as Nephilim. It is the second generation, in other words, the offspring of the giants, who are the Nephilim, and they in turn will produce offspring of their own, the Eliud. If nothing else, these Eliud, about whom very little is known outside Jewish mystical traditions, are further evidence of the close genetic relationship between watchers and humans, so close that they must really be classified as the same species. Generally, when two different species breed, even when they are close enough to produce offspring, such as horses and donkeys, for example, those offspring are themselves sterile. But unlike the sterile mules that result from horse-donkey matings, the Nephilim are clearly not sterile, since they themselves are able to go on to produce offspring, in other words, the Eliud. The only reasonable conclusion, as I've already indicated, is that the Watchers must have been human beings, no doubt surrounded by some aura or glamour to do with their mastery of technology and the sciences, but no more and no less human than the women they mated with, and that therefore their offspring were human too. Quite possibly they were of large stature. Quite possibly the epithet of giants attached to them may also have had something to do with their intellectual abilities, which might have been seen to be superior, but they were human nonetheless, and I see no good reason to conclude otherwise. Meanwhile, because this is a subject around which much confusion swirls, it is necessary to reiterate that there is no suggestion, either in Genesis or in Numbers, the only places they are mentioned in the Bible, that the Nephilim had fallen, even in the metaphorical sense of having sinned. On the contrary, far from being censured, they are described as mighty men of old, heroes, men of renown. Genesis is unequivocal, as the reader can confirm from the passages cited earlier, that it is human wickedness and the evil in human hearts that causes God to send the flood, a cataclysm that is survived not only by Noah's descendants, but by the Nephilim themselves, who were still in Canaan and still of great stature, as the book of Numbers attests, when the Israelites came to take possession of the promised land. Emissaries. After this brief excursion into the foundations of the Sitchin Nephilim cult, let us return to the Watchers and who and what they might be. Enoch's condemnation of them for fornicating with human women finds its counterpart in Genesis, where, though not named, they are clearly the sons of God, who saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. Thereafter, the story of exactly what happened is only preserved in Enoch, where we're led to understand that the Watchers taught all unrighteousness on earth and revealed the eternal secrets which were preserved in heaven, which men were striving to learn. Turning now to another of the non-canonical scriptures, the Book of Jubilees, which purports to be a revelation given by God to Moses, we read of the Watchers again, and in a context that brings us back to the Sabians and Haran. According both to the Islamic historian Al-Masudi and the Christian chronicler Gregory Bar Hebraeus, Haran was originally founded by Canaan, the great-grandson of Noah. By definition, therefore, though early, Haran is a post-diluvian city. Canaan, sometimes the name is spelled Canaam, was the son of Arabshad. And the son grew, and his father taught him writing, and he went to seek for himself a place where he might seize for himself a city. And he found a writing, which former generations had carved on the rock, and he read what was thereon, and he transcribed it and sinned owing to it, for it contained the teaching of the Watchers, in accordance with which they used to observe the omens of the sun, moon, and stars in all the signs of heaven. Here, then, is the origin of the star worship of the Sabians, traced all the way back to the mysterious Watchers, whoever they were, whatever they were, who settled in the Near East in antediluvian times, taught our ancestors forbidden knowledge, broke some fundamental commandment by mating with human women, and as a result were remembered as being responsible for the great global cataclysm of the deluge. Were these Watchers the emissaries of a lost civilization of the Ice Age? perhaps a civilization as far ahead of the Upper Paleolithic hunter-gatherers, who made up the majority of the population of the world at that time, as our own civilization is ahead of uncontacted tribes in the Amazon rainforest today. When I say ahead, I am, of course, not speaking of moral or spiritual values, but simply of technology, skills, and knowledge. Since such discrepancies still exist in the 21st century, I see no reason in principle why they shouldn't have existed in the remote epoch before the great cataclysms of the Younger Dryas set in between 10,800 BC and 9,600 BC. To continue with this line of speculation, could it be that there was some sort of outreach before those cataclysms? A very careful, considered, structured outreach program to observe, to study, in other words, to watch hunter-gatherer populations, but not to intermingle with them, not to enter into the complicated entanglements of sexual and family relationships with them, and above all, not to transfer any technology to them. One could imagine that a group of anthropologists and scientists sent off to study a previously uncontacted Amazon tribe today might be bound by similar strictures. But suppose some of them disagreed. Suppose some of them went native, as used to be said of colonialists in the days of the British Empire, who allowed themselves to get too close to indigenous populations they interacted with. Is that perhaps what happened to the troop of 200 watchers on Mount Hermon? Somewhere around 10,900 BC, did they break the commandments of their own culture and go native amongst the hunter-gatherers of the Near East? And were the first chance encounters with the fragments of a giant comet a century later in 10,800 BC, encounters that devastated the world, somehow blamed upon their moral lapse? And some final thoughts. Did their civilization survive, albeit in truncated, damaged, reduced form, through the rigors of the Younger Dryas, until the second fateful encounter with the comet's debris stream in 9,600 BC that ended the long, fatal winter, but also led to the final sinking and destruction of the homeland of the primeval ones? That island realm, far off in the ocean, that bears such striking resemblances to Plato's description of Atlantis. Was it then that the last survivors of the once advanced and prosperous civilization set out to wander the world in ships to initiate their great design intended ultimately, perhaps after thousands of years, to bring about the resurrection of the former world of the gods? And were Egypt, Baalbek, and Göbekli Tepe amongst the places these magicians of the gods chose to settle in order to set their plan in motion, perhaps precisely because there had been outreach in these areas before the cataclysms, and therefore their potential and the character of their inhabitants were known? Was Haran part of the second stage of this plan, when the work of the last initiates at Göbekli Tepe was done, and the time capsule they had created there was buried to be rediscovered in a future age? Buried in the bowels of the earth, like that white porphyry stone spoken of in the Masonic tradition cited earlier, or like the writing carved on rock containing the teachings of the Watchers, which Kenan found and transcribed at the time he established Haran, bringing into his city knowledge of the omens of the sun, moon, and stars, and all the signs in heaven. Knowledge of exactly the type that would be central to the mysterious star religion of the Sabians in the millennia to come. Astronomy and Earth Measuring. Archaeoastronomer James Q. Jacobs has noticed something rather odd about Haran. The city's latitude, 36.87 degrees north of the equator, appears to be non-random, since the figure is the same as that for the acute angle of a 3-4-5 right triangle, in other words, a triangle which contains one 90-degree right angle and whose side lengths are in the ratio of 3-4-5. In all such triangles, which form the basis for trigonometry and are thus fundamental to astronomy and geodesy, the other two angles are, with rounding, 53.13 degrees and 36.87 degrees. Is it a coincidence that a 3-4-5 right triangle with the same internal angles exists inside the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid of Egypt? The floor of this austere and uninscribed red granite room in which no pharaoh was ever found entombed forms a 2-to-1 rectangle, exactly 20 Egyptian royal cubits in length and 10 royal cubits in width, 10.46 by 5.23 meters. The right triangle is formed with its shortest dimension, 15 cubits, represented by the diagonal across the west wall from the lower southwest corner to the upper northwest corner. Its median dimension, 20 cubits, is drawn along the entire length of the floor on the south side of the chamber. Its long dimension, 25 cubits, is drawn from the upper northwest corner of the chamber to the lower southeast corner. These side lengths of 15 cubits, 20 cubits, and 25 cubits can be expressed as the ratio 3, 4, 5, because if we allocate the value 3 to the length of 15 cubits, then 20 cubits must naturally have a value of 4, and 25 cubits must have a value of 5. All right-angled triangles with side lengths in this special 3, 4, 5 ratio are called Pythagorean after Pythagoras, the Greek philosopher and mathematician of the 6th century BC, who was supposedly the first to discover that they share a unique characteristic. This is that the square of the short side, 3 units by 3 units equals 9 units, added to the square of the median side, 4 units by 4 units equals 16 units, together result in a figure equal to the square of the long side, 5 units by 5 units equals 25 units, in other words, the sum of 9 plus 16. The real secret magic of the triangle, however, as the Icelandic mathematician Einar Pálsson has pointed out, is only revealed when the numbers are cubed. Then we get 3 by 3 by 3 equals 27, 4 by 4 by 4 equals 64, 5 by 5 by 5 equals 125. The total of 27 plus 64 plus 125 is 216. And as the reader will recall from earlier chapters, 216 is one of the sequence of numbers identified by historians of science Giorgio de Santillana and Hertha von Deschend as being derived from precise observations of the precession of the equinoxes, those long-term changes in the sky that unfold at the rate of 1 degree every 72 years. Numbers derived from this precessional sequence turn out to be encoded in ancient myths and monuments all around the world, tracing their origins back to what Santillana and von Deschend can only conclude was some almost unbelievable ancestor civilization of prehistoric antiquity that first dared to understand the world as created according to number, measure, and weight. The heartbeat of the cycle, as we've seen, is 72, the number of years required for the unfolding of 1 degree of precessional change. In observational terms, a 1 degree shift over 72 years, effectively an entire human lifetime, is barely perceptible, being roughly equivalent to the width of a forefinger held up towards the horizon. A 30-degree shift through one entire zodiacal constellation requiring 30 by 72 equals 2,160 years to complete is impossible to miss. But its progression could only be precisely recorded and noted by many generations of conscientious and accurate observers. A 60-degree shift, in other words, through 2 zodiacal constellations, takes 4,320 years, 2,160 times 2 equals 4,320, which is why a 360-degree shift, all 12 zodiacal constellations, the great year, requires a grand total of 25,920 years. Within the precessional code, as Santillana and von Deschend showed conclusively, it is permissible to divide and multiply the heartbeat number of 72, the number of years required for 1 degree of precessional change. This is done in myths and monuments all around the world, for example at Angkor in Cambodia, as we saw in Chapter 12, and at Borobudur in Indonesia, as we will see in Chapter 18. Thus, 216 is 3 times 72, or 2,160 divided by 10. Its derivation from the 3-4-5 triangle inside the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid is therefore most unlikely to be an accident, and the relationship of all this to astronomy and geodesy, earth measuring, is clear. This is further confirmed by the external dimensions of the Great Pyramid, which, as I showed in Fingerprints of the Gods, encode the dimensions of our planet on the precessional scale of 1 to 43,200. Essentially, if you measure the height of the Great Pyramid and multiply it by 43,200, you get the polar radius of the Earth, And if you measure the base perimeter of the Great Pyramid and multiply it by 43,200, you get the equatorial circumference of the Earth. The fact that 43,200 is one of the sequence of precessional numbers identified by Santillana and von Deschenes further reduces the likelihood of coincidence and requires us to take seriously the proposition that we are indeed looking at part of the intellectual legacy of some almost unbelievable ancestor civilization that had measured the Earth and observed the changes in the stars with scientific accuracy long before what we understand as history began. So to return to Harran, James Q. Jacobs' discovery certainly suggests that the founders of this city made a deliberate geodetic choice when they set it at latitude 36.87 degrees north.